concerns me about the future of missile defense in Alaska.
Alaska senators express concern over missile defense changes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 18th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the cruise ship industry sues the state.
We feel that the entry fee or head tax as it's been implemented by the state, is illegal.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Alaska senators are reacting to President Obama's announcement yesterday that he's scrapping the Bush-era missile defense system in Europe in favor of a more mobile, cheaper system. The move away from the European ground-based system has the congressional delegation wondering what it means for Fort Greely in Delta Junction. It also hosts a ground-based system designed to shoot down long and mid-range missiles. President Obama says countries like Iran present a threat through short-range missiles, not long-range ones. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's concerned the president's plan will leave the U.S. vulnerable.
It concerns me about the future of missile defense in Alaska and on a larger scale, just the future of ground-based missile defense for our nation.
Murkowski says Congress had no heads up about the change in plan. Republicans blasted it, while Democrats largely praised the president's decision to cancel radar units in the Czech Republic and interceptors in Poland. Instead, the system will be mobile and mostly based in ships. Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who also served under President Bush, supports Obama's decision. Democratic Senator Mark Begich has been a champion of the missile defense system, but says the shift in direction in Europe may ultimately strengthen the Alaska-based program.
The ground base in Europe was a big discussion point of this whole mix. Well, now that's out of it, it makes our system, I think, even more valuable.
Begich says now Alaska will have the only back-end part of the system designed to stop long-range attacks. He says Defense Secretary Gates and top military leaders have testified to Congress that an effective program must include some long-range defense.
I don't disagree with having the more mobile system, but that's based on what technology North Korea and Iran have today. Our own people tell us in 5 years they'll have ground-based missiles that will be long-range. And for us not to be ahead of that curve would be a huge mistake.
Despite Senator Begich's optimism, the White House has reined in plans at Fort Greely in recent months and advocated capping the number of silos there. Critics of the missile defense program also question its reliability. But Begich says with cost savings now in the European system, he hopes to bring more money home to Alaska. Senator Murkowski says she's not as hopeful the Fort Greely program will get a boost.
I might, if there had not been such mixed signals and dare I suggest, negative signals just earlier this year. So far, the administration has not demonstrated any willingness to revisit their earlier decision to cap the number of missiles there at Fort Greely.
The White House has not given any indication this week that the plans for Europe will affect the Alaska-based system. The cruise industry is suing the state to throw out most of the passenger head tax. The Alaska Cruise Association filed the suit Thursday afternoon in U.S. District Court in Anchorage. The state says it will defend the tax. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
Cruise lines have been threatening to go to court for months. Now they've filed their legal paperwork saying the tax violates terms of the U.S. Constitution as well as specific federal law. John Binkley is president of the Alaska Cruise Association, which represents 9 lines that sail state waters.
We feel that the entry fee or head tax is, as it's been implemented by the state, is illegal, and that it really does hurt Alaskans and Alaskan businesses in terms of the economy, and that the court system really is the best venue or the place to resolve the issue.
Cruise passengers are charged a $50 excise tax, which generates about $50 million a year. $4 funds the Ocean Rangers Environmental Monitoring Program. The other $46 goes to port cities in the state for docks, tourist facilities, and other work. Binkley says the $46 tax forces visitors to pay for government projects that have nothing to do with cruise ships, but the industry is not challenging the remaining amount.
Well, the $4 is really a specific service to the ships and to the passengers that we don't feel is illegal. And so that's why we haven't challenged that portion.
The lawsuit is against State Revenue Commissioner Patrick Galvin because his agency collects the tax. Attorney General Dan Sullivan says the Department of Law will vigorously defend the tax. Governor Sean Parnell has promised to do the same. No court date has been set. The fee was put into place by the Cruise Ship Initiative, a ballot proposition approved by voters in 2006. The tourism industry says it's driven three lines to pull ships out of the Alaska market next year. Initiative author Joe Geldof says the economy is hurting the industry more than the tax, and he says the cruise lines are taking a cowardly approach by going to court.
They have tossed in the proverbial kitchen sink and every other theory pretty much that they can claim, but at the heart of the matter, and the most interesting one, is the issue of whether or not the excise tax levied on the passengers was properly spent.
Tax backers say much of the money has been used properly. They point to funding for dock repairs, mooring buoys, and harbor dredging. But they have criticized legislative appropriations to the Anchorage Zoo, the Wasilla Railroad Station, and the Palmer Visitor Center. Initiative backer Chip Toma represents the group Responsible Cruising in Alaska.
We want to make sure, and we've been very conservative about this in expressing that to the legislature, that we think it ought to be spent as close to the ships, as close to the docks as possible for primary infrastructure. And if they do that, we think it will survive any kind of a legal test. But spreading that money far and beyond and away from the docks is probably not the best idea.
Toma's group went to former Governor Sarah Palin and the legislature with its concerns. He says cruise lines should have done the same thing. Binkley says cruise lines already tried that approach. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, rural kids face lots of adjustments in urban schools.
They go and they stand in line, they have to get a lunch card. They might not even have ever experienced to have a lunch card before or to rattle off their student ID number because somebody in their village already knew their name and their family.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus Oregon Province.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is considering proposing an amendment that would limit the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to regulate greenhouse gases. Environmentalists are slamming the possible legislation. It would allow the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases only from mobile sources. It would not be able to restrict emissions from stationary places like industrial plants or power plants for 1 year. Murkowski is still deciding whether or not to introduce the amendment, according to her press secretary, Ann Johnson. Murkowski is the top Republican on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee and may tack her amendment onto the 2010 Interior and Environment Appropriations Bill, now before the Senate. Johnson says the senator wants policy to come from Congress, not the EPA.
Basically, she is trying to get some time for Congress to be able to produce legislation that will address climate change without this impending hammer of the EPA.
The EPA is in the process of finalizing an endangerment finding, which may bring about more regulations of greenhouse gas emissions. That's being done in response to a 2007 Supreme Court decision ordering the EPA to reconsider whether greenhouse gas emissions are pollutants and subject to federal regulation through the Clean Air Act. Johnson says the amendment Murkowski is considering would create a year-long time out, regardless of the EPA findings.
This gives Congress another year to craft meaningful legislation in a way that isn't going to hurt the economy, which is it's very likely that any EPA regulations will do.
Environmentalists are blasting the proposal. Frank O'Donnell, president of the environmental watchdog group Clean Air Watch, says the amendment would meddle with the EPA's rulemaking process.
Senator Murkowski would attempt to handcuff the EPA to say that the EPA may not proceed to do anything about the global warming emissions from things like oil refineries, could not do anything about coal-burning electric power plants. Our concern is that this appears to be special interest pandering, that Senator Murkowski is putting the good of these big polluters over the interest of the general public and the planet.
Murkowski's spokeswoman says no time would be lost under the possible amendment, since climate change legislation now before Congress wouldn't even go into effect for 3 years. But O'Donnell says any delay of the EPA's plans is a setback.
We have seen in the past that these one-year things get renewed. We saw it in the 1990s when Republicans prevented any action on global warming through the very similar process of saying the EPA could not spend any money on it. And that happened year after year after year. So it's a very dangerous precedent and one that has a history.
Murkowski's office says she'll likely decide whether to introduce the amendment on Monday. The lieutenant governors of Alaska and Vermont traveled to two western Alaska villages this week to see Vermont-made wind turbines that are helping the remote communities lower their power costs. Following the trip, the lieutenant governors held a public meeting on energy in Fairbanks yesterday. Alaska Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell says the Vermont-made turbines are lessening the Alaska villages' dependence on diesel power.
That industry that is now developed in Vermont and is being utilized in other places has come to Alaska and is taking what we have, wind, and seeing the opportunities that can be provided to Alaskans. We just came from Unalakleet yesterday, where we spent the day looking at the investment being made by the Unalakleet Valley Electric Cooperative on wind power for that community. And it's not the only one. There are many other examples out there. But in Unalakleet, they're expected to have an offset of 25% of their diesel power by having these wind turbines working.
Campbell credited the state legislature for setting up a $100 million renewable energy fund that's helping communities pay for projects, including wind turbines. He says wind energy can provide growth potential in villages where the economy is bleak.
You make the capital investment, you bring in the system, it augments and reduces the cost of energy. It allows for more productivity and more availability for development in rural Alaska. It is the right solution as part of a total package for energy in Alaska.
Campbell and Vermont Lieutenant Governor Brian Duby also visited a wind farm at Gamble on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. Duby said the Northwind 100 turbine, produced in his state, provides key safety backup for remote communities like Gamble in the event of an emergency.
When you maybe don't get the ability to get the diesel shipments in. So for a diversity of solutions, wind really makes a lot of sense, especially in rural western Alaska.
The state of Alaska has set a goal of getting 50% of its energy from renewable sources by 2025. The Forest Service is reporting a surge in requests to build hydroelectric projects on the Tongass National Forest. Tongass Supervisor Forrest Cole says the Forest Service ultimately currently has 12 applicants for hydro developments within the country's largest national forest.
We have spent a significant amount of time on the Sully River area in near Hydra. The Lake Shlocum area has come up. It all comes on the heels of just completing the forest plan amendment, where we really didn't deal with any changes significantly to hydro development. We were dealing with some court issues.
With annual rainfall averages in the region ranging from 29 to 160 inches, many Southeast Alaska communities have long relied on hydropower for their electricity needs. Cole says the Forest Service understood there was an increasing interest in hydroelectric projects before completing its most recent amendment of the Tongass Land Management Plan last January.
What we came to realize is, given all of the intricacies of these proposals, there was no way we could address each one in a forest plan. So, like Sully River, not having a lot of the special data on what that proposal was going to entail, we essentially did not deal with it at the forest plan level. We would do it with it on a individual project basis. And it may necessitate changing a forest plan. It may necessitate living with what the forest plan and modifying the proposal.
Leading the charge on the hydro front is Alaska Power and Telephone. The company is proposing to construct multiple hydroelectric facilities on the Tongass, including a project at Lake Shelicum north of Ketchikan and another on the Soli River near Hyder. The Soli project would be the larger of the two projects, consisting of a 1,000-foot long and 160-foot high dam. Cole says any amendment to the forest plan dealing with the hydroelectricity issue would go through a full environmental assessment and public comment process. Petersburg will keep an Office of Children's Services social worker. This comes after a community outcry and legislators' intervention when it appeared earlier this month that the office would be closed. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
In a telephone conversation early Thursday morning, Office of Children's Services Director Tammy Sandoval told State Representative Peggy Wilson that the office will keep a social worker position in Petersburg. Wilson, in turn, told her constituents about the news in an email.
Well, right now what the outcome is and the compromise is that we are going to have a caseworker stay in Petersburg, and that office will stay open, and the person in and that the supervisor position will instead of going to Juneau will go to Sitka.
The local office serves Petersburg, Wrangell, and Cake. It's currently staffed by two social workers. Supervisor Debbie Downs will soon be retiring. Her colleague Bruce Westry is a retired law enforcement officer who was also planning to leave his position in the fall. They expected the agency would keep at least one of the positions in Petersburg after they retired. However, Downs said early this month that her superiors had told her both positions would be moved to Juneau and that local cases would be handled out of that office. At the time, officials with OCS declined to comment in detail on the issue, saying they had not yet made a decision. But the potential loss of both local positions prompted an outcry from municipal leaders, social service providers, mental health clinicians, educators, foster parents, and other area residents and officials. They said the lack of a local caseworker would have major impacts in Petersburg and the other communities, especially in the area of child abuse prevention. One of the people who spoke out on the issue in Petersburg was local police chief Dale Stone. Stone is thrilled that OCS has now decided to keep a social worker in town. At the same time, he's sad to see the current employees retire.
Matt, it's kind of a good news, bad news situation. It's just excellent news that we're able to keep the social worker position here in Petersburg to serve Petersburg and Wrangell and Cake as well. But the importance of that whole position is the interworking between agencies and with families directly, and to know the community and to know the people they're working for is just a huge plus. And the groundwork for that sort of service has been left by two people that we're going to be losing through retirement now, and that's Deborah Downs and Bruce Westry. And I can't say enough about the excellent service they've provided to the community.
Stone was glad to hear that the Office of Children's Services was planning to have some overlap between the retirement of the current social workers and the hiring of a new one. According to Representative Wilson's email to constituents, the office will be working to ensure a smooth transition. Office of Children's Services Director Tammy Sandoval was out of the office and not available for an interview on Thursday, according to spokesperson Susan Morgan. However, Morgan confirmed the information provided by Wilson in an email to KFSK Public Radio. She said, quote, "There never was a decision made to move both positions. It was being discussed internally, and what resulted from those discussions is what you see described in Representative Wilson's email." In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
Alaska Native students in urban settings have some new education assistance. Project Bohituk may open the way for a high school diploma for at-risk Alaska Native kids in city high schools. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Last month, the Anchorage School District got the news from U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan that it would be the recipient of a $1.2 million grant to put together a program to help Alaskan Native students in danger of dropping out of school. ASD Superintendent Carol Como says the new program depends on innovations in how students are taught.
We have a higher percentage of at-risk young people struggling in our schools who are Alaska Native American Indian, so they designed this program in this grant proposal, and we were really thrilled when the secretary announced it.
Como says the school system needs to be more flexible in providing culturally responsive classes for at-risk students. Doreen Brown heads ASD's Indian Education Program. She is part of a team that put the grant proposal together with the help of a Native Advisory Committee.
One of the things that I looked at was First Alaskans Getting Behind the Numbers report that came out in 2006, and they really looked at the dropout rate, and they collected information and data about why that dropout rate was so high for Native students. And there were a couple of things that came up, and that's the transiency of our students coming from rural to urban, and subsistence was another thing that entered these students' lives and why they were one of the factors of dropping out. Homelessness was another one, and another thing that came up was the large school systems.
Brown says the designers wanted to respond to parent and student requests for more online classes. She says the new program will provide an opportunity for kids to be involved in education at any time from almost any location.
Learning in a virtual environment really can address all of these issues. If a child has to go home for whatever reason, maybe they have to go moose hunting, but they're enrolled in the school district, they enrolled in one of our courses, they can go hunting and then come back and make up. And that environment, the teacher really gets to spend a lot of time with that student online.
The grant provides funding for 3 years, starting with an initial payment of $521,000 this year. Some of the funding will be spent on teacher training, and the ASD will work with the Alaska Native Heritage Center, Native corporations, and UAA in some instances. Como says the pilot program may pave the way for others like it.
There are lots of ways with technology now that we can really enhance cultural opportunities for young people from all cultures. There's no reason in my mind that we can't apply a lot of these practices to lots of our students who are mobile, who are transient, who have to leave for a little while because of all kinds of family situations that will allow them to continue to work in school and be online and keep up with their credits and their peers. And that's a pretty powerful message for young people.
As for the name, Buhituk is a Chupik word that means smart person. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The potential closure of a shellfish hatchery in Seward could spell significant problems for Southeast Alaska's fledgling mariculture industry. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough is looking at constructing a new facility that could either supplement or replace the Seward hatchery if it's unable to continue operating.
Gooey duck farmers Kurt Morin and Gary Zog addressed the Ketchikan Planning Liaison and Economic Development Advisory Committee, describing the operational and logistical barriers to getting their industry off the ground. During their relatively short careers as gooey duck farmers, the two have weathered regulatory battles with fish and game and allocation disputes with the commercial dive industry. Now Morin says his sole supply of plentiful gooey duck seeds is in jeopardy as the Seward-based Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery struggles to stay afloat.
Technically, they're closed. They're closed because they don't have funding to operate. And so we're working to help them find funding and get opening again.
Phone calls to the Aleutic Hatchery were not returned. However, in an August 25th letter to Governor Sean Parnell, Aleutic Hatchery Director Jeff Hetrick said the hatchery had become a victim of Alaska's up-and-down economy and the national recession. He said Aleutic recently began closing its shellfish hatchery and marine research facility, laying off two of the hatchery's three employees. Hetrick says the hatchery needs $100,000 to reopen in January. Aleutic provides products to shellfish farmers around the state, growing everything from clams to oyster seeds. Unlike oysters, gooey duck must be spawned in Alaska. Warren says Alutiiq is the only source of gooey duck seed for farmers in the state.
Gooey duck is my primary concern, although they do a lot more. They produce oysters for the oyster farmers, and they produce a lot of oysters. Now, gooey duck, however, we can't import that.
There are over 20 gooey duck farms in Alaska, many of which are located in or around the Ketchikan Gateway Borough. Borough Economic Development Manager Deborah Hayden sees potential for the new industry.
The Chinese are right now paying $16 a pound for them, and the average gooey duck is 2 pounds. So that's $32 per gooey duck. And it costs somewhere like between $5, $6 a gooey duck to produce them. So you can do the math and figure out what the margin is on that, and that this could be a tremendously lucrative industry for Southeast Alaska.
She says the immediate goal of the gooey duck farmers is to reach 1 million pounds in exports. At current prices, that would mean the industry would take in approximately $16 million annually once it gets off the ground. Warren says his and other farmers' first crop of gooey ducks is still maturing. Once farmers begin harvesting their crops, Hayden says an estimated 20 commercial divers could work year-round, planting and harvesting the farms and continuing to participate in wild dive fisheries. She estimates a diver working year-round could make approximately $150,000 annually. To help the industry, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough is looking at constructing a new facility that could either supplement or replace Alutiiq if the hatchery fails to continue operating. Warren and Zog backed the idea of building a so-called enhanced mariculture nursery that could grow shellfish seeds that have been spawned by Alutiiq. The facility would also be capable of spawning gooey duck and other shellfish seed in the event that Alutiiq closed.
We want to keep them going. We want them to do our spawning, but we want to have the capability, if we lose them in the future, that we can spawn as well. It's much cheaper to build a facility ready to do that than to come back 3 or 5 years or further down the road and say, oh, now we need a hatchery.
The Ketchikan Gateway Borough Assembly this month authorized the borough to apply for and accept a $100,000 USDA grant for the construction of a community-enhanced nursery. The proposed nursery would be built on borough property at Ward Cove and cost an estimated $500,000 to construct and operate the first year. Hayden says a borough would lease the proposed facility to a yet-to-be-formed cooperative of area shellfish farmers. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Engineering Fund, whose members include USKH Incorporated, creating sustainable solutions to support the quality of life for communities. Information online at uskh.com. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus Oregon Province.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.